So I have 3 o'clock now, so we shall begin. Couple coming in. So because it's suttas, I usually do a namo tassa to begin with. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So this afternoon we're going to be discussing a sutta called Anupada. I'm not going to give it the normal translation name because that is bad Pali to translate it the way it is usually translated. When Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi did the second edition of the middle length sayings, you know, this book which some of you have here, I did actually send my complaints to him. That's not Pali, but he said that that was what his teacher, Venerable Nyanaponika, translated, and they were going to stick with his teacher. But we'll come up to that in a moment. There's many, many interesting things about the Anupada Sutta, and it's one of the reasons why in all the suttas which I have taught here, I've always left that one out, because it is controversial. And to know exactly why it is controversial, that I began on the screen there, quoting from this little booklet which was done by Bhikkhu Sujata and Bhikkhu Bamali, who you all know, Ajahn Sujata and Ajahn Bamali, The Authenticity of the Early Buddhist Texts, because there is always and always will be controversy about what actually was taught by the Buddha, what came later. But whenever we look at the authenticity of ancient texts, we can never use the criteria, I don't agree with that, that doesn't fit into my idea of what the Buddha taught. We have to use other criteria, more objective reasons, why we doubt some passages and why we agree with other passages. And of course, you know, this is controversial stuff. And especially, just even recently, when I was replying to one gentleman in Sri Lanka about, say, the legitimacy of the Abhidhamma, whether that was taught by the Buddha. And of course, many sort of people, they really raise their hackles, even to suggest that his Abhidhamma was actually late. And the point is that at least, you know, maybe as a Westerner, fearless about, you know, saying it's bad karma, Ajahn Brahm, you'll go to hell by even suggesting that, which some monks actually say, that that was too much similar to the background which you had in Christianity or Islam or other things. Whenever you doubt without reason, using fear as your main argument. But we have something like, I think it's the fifth book in the Abhidhamma, the Katawatu. And even inside of that, that was mentioned, as even inside the text, it was a discussion which happened in the time just post-Asoka, in about at least 150, 200 years after the time of the Buddha. And actually to even assume that that was actually spoken by the Buddha, it's one of those things which, if you said that as a Christian, you would be said, you're not being scientific, you're not being reasonable, you're leaving your brain outside the temple. So it's important actually to use some reason, some logic. And this is good on Ajahn Sujata and Ajahn Bamali, who use objective criteria, the same sort of criteria which are used, you know, in these days to find out, say, in the Christianity, what was actually happened, you know, in the time of Jesus. In the Gospels, were they written in the time of Jesus by the, you four sort of apostles who had eyewitness knowledge of it, or did it come afterwards? So we have to be sort of quite objective if we want to find out what is the earliest teachings of the Buddha, what is authentic, and what could be added afterwards. And not because you don't like them, those teachings, or you do like them, but because there's other criteria. And these are some of the criteria which they use especially for the Anuppada Sutta, the 111. And if you can read it there, I'll just read it out, pages 104 to 105. There's only a limited edition of these, the actual book itself, but it is available online. It's called Creative Commons. Ajahn Sujata was really keen to make it as available as possible. So not in actually bookshops. You can't get this in a bookshop. But this was available online. Just Authenticity of Early Buddhist Texts, Bhikkhu Sutata, Bhikkhu Bamali. You can get it on there pretty easily. And if you can't, you can go and see Ajahn Bamali. And he will sort of show you how to get into it. So this is part of this book, Authenticity of the Early Buddhist Texts. Later texts or passages typically reveal themselves in multiple different ways. These are the later ones, which indicates the ancient Buddhists were not interested in composing realistic fakes. He's saying they could have done better if they really wanted to hide it. In identifying later additions to the canon, it is usually possible to use multiple independent criteria. For example, in the case of Majjhima 111, the Anuppada Sutta, the following five criteria are relevant. And first of all, there's no known parallels in non-Pali early Buddhist texts. And I think many of you will know from the history of the spread of Buddhism that these Buddhist texts were transmitted not just throughout India, but down to Sri Lanka, and most importantly, up into China. And there they became what's known as the Agamas. There's very authentic records of Chinese pilgrims going over to India and collecting texts and carrying them back, mostly on ships back into China, and spending the rest of their lives transliterating those texts into Chinese characters. It wasn't so much as translation, because every word has a different character. And so they can find out the character for Dhamma, kind of the character for Buddha, and the character for enlightenment. And then you have those characters. It makes it much easier to actually translate it back again into Sanskrit or whatever other language you wish to translate it into. And so because of that in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length sayings, I was going to ask Ajahn Bamada this, but there's hardly any suttas, maybe one or two, but this is the main one, which have no parallel at all in the Chinese Agama. It simply doesn't exist in there, which is very strange. It doesn't exist in the Chinese Agamas. Extravagant praise of Sariputta not found elsewhere in the early Buddhist texts, and akin to the flowery and exaggerated languages of other Buddhist texts. You'll find that very often they will praise the Buddha, but they would very rarely praise any of the disciples. And in this text you will find that even the language of praising the Sariputta is much more common to what they have in other later traditions. And as I'll point out when we go through this, textual duplication and redundancy. In some of the descriptions here, they repeat just words twice instead of actually, you don't do that in real speech. I just did it. Hope you were hearing that. It's when it's written down, you don't have such duplication. That is an anomaly. And the Abhidharma type vocabulary, not found elsewhere in the early Buddhist texts, And such as Anupada Wawatita, I'll mention that later on, and juxtaposition of different literary style. Specifically, one sutta style list of jhana factors connected with cha, and one Abhidhamma style list of factors without cha. This may not be really stand out for you, but those people who know Pali, cha means and. And so if you have, we have today Ajahn Brahm, cha, Ajahn Venerable Nibbuto, cha, we have John Treasure, cha, we have Dr. Mukta, cha, we have Nicole, cha. Cha just means what you put after every word, meaning and. But there's too many cha later on that people just didn't use that word anymore. They just put Ajahn Brahm, Nibbuto, John Treasure, Mukta, and Nicole, just at the end. Different styles of language, which shows what is early, what is later. And there's other reasons why that this is regarded by most people as a much later text, or rather a text which has other things which have been added into it, which you will soon find out. Any questions to begin with? Okay, so here we go. First of all, Anupada, step by step. Because straight away, the Anupada cannot mean in any sort of interpretation one by one as they occurred. Or one by one as they arose. And you can see here just a little note. One by one as they arose, this is included confusing Anupada with a compound Anupada. And I think many of you may have heard the word Upada because it's one of the most famous verses which are chanted at funerals, which are supposed to be chanted at the Buddha's own cremation ceremony. Anicca Vata Sankara Upada Vaya Dhammino Upajitava Nirujanti Tesang Upasamo Sukho. The Anicca Vata, you know what Anicca? Anicca Vata means alas. Sankara. Or, impermanent are all compounded things. Upada Vaya Dhammino. Once they arise, they're the nature to pass away. Arising, Upada. That's a different word, Upada. So, it's not the word as they occur. It means step by step. Any of you who want to go into the library and to look in the Pali Text Society dictionary or any other dictionary we have there, you'll see that it means just step by step, line by line. So, straight away, you change the title, and that word is used during the whole of the text, and you find it has a different connotation to this sutta. So, I'm going to be following the translation which I did, and remember that many things get lost in translation, as we keep on saying. So, lost in translation, this is the translation which I stand by. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One, that's the Buddha, was living at Sarvati in Jetus Grove and Artapindika's Park. There he addressed the monks thus. Monks, Venerable Sir, they replied. The Blessed One said this. This is not gender specific, this is historic, because in that place at the time, there were just monks listening to this. Monks, Sariputta is wise. Sariputta has great wisdom. Sariputta has wise wisdom. Sariputta has joyous wisdom. Sariputta has quick wisdom. Sariputta has keen wisdom. Sariputta has penetrative wisdom. So even that is what was picked up by Ajahn Siddhartha and Ajahn Bhamali and also Ajahn Analiyo, that this is not the sort of the way that they would usually praise anyone. Maybe the Buddha, but certainly not Sariputta or anyone else. And Sariputta entered upon and abided in the first jhana, wherein the mind moves onto the object and holds onto it, the object being joy and pleasure caused by being totally free from the five senses. And the states, first of all, this is the usual translation which you've heard from me before, of the first jhana. Over in the Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, again it's controversial simply because not that many people have real experience of the jhanas. These days what happens now, jhanas have become popular. And once they become popular, the standard is lowered down so that many people feel that they can get jhanas. Whereas the real jhanas, they are what they call uttari manusa dhamma. These are high states of meditation, not ordinary states. They are so exalted by the Buddha that any monk or nun who claims to have experience of those jhanas and they are lying, that is the same offense, a parajika, as if that you had committed sexual intercourse, killed a human being deliberately, or stolen expensive things. It's a very serious offense, which is why the monks, we have to be very, very careful what we say. And that's even if we say it to another monk. Usually if we say even true attainments, things which monks really have experienced, to a lay person and not a ordained person, that is still an offence of paticca. But when we make it up, that's an offence of disrobal. So it's very serious, which means we take the idea, the definitions of jhanas really, really carefully, really seriously. And it is, I think, known that Ajahn Brahm is one of the toughest. When it comes to a jhana, I don't tell people they have a jhana lightly. And we're going to find out something about that in a moment. One of the things which is said, the applied thought and sustained thought, this is vitakka vichara. Now the idea of thinking within a jhana, to me, is just a no-brainer. Within a jhana, you cannot think. You cannot verbalize. To the point that if anyone is in one of these deep states, and they say, I'm in jhana, or is this jhana, then that is a clear indication you're not in a jhana. The thinking, I should have got this quote out, but I can find it later on. What the Buddha called thought, and how he considered thinking when he taught, was comparing it to a young man or a young woman dressed out, ready to go out for the night, and finding they have a garland of carcasses of dead dogs around their neck. That's pretty gross. But in that simile, the nice, clean, well-dressed, coiffured, groomed person, that was like the mind. And the carcass of dead dogs was the thoughts. So it's pretty, fierce how the Buddha talked about thoughts. And so instead of thinking in the first jhana, instead of thinking, it's vitakka vichara is used in a different way, like words are used in different ways in contexts. When I've been teaching the word of the Buddha, I always make a point of saying, you should never translate words, you should translate sentences. And what's the usual one which I use? It was raining cats and dogs. That's a really silly translation when it's raining heavily. Cats, dogs do not fall from the sky. It means it's raining heavily. But it's just an idiom, a way of speaking. So, not to confuse people, always translate sentences. Words have different meanings in different contexts. So, the here, it would mean what I call a movement of the mind onto the object and holding the object. Why the mind is still moving in the first jhana is because it is not stable. Its stability has not finished yet. It's not totally stable. It's stable enough to be apart from the body and the five senses. Five senses stopped. Can't see, can't hear, smell, taste, touch. Those have been subdued. Five senses subdued, so the sixth sense, the mind, can manifest. And that as that mind manifests, as I think I was saying on yesterday and in the meditation class, as the five senses disappear, the energy which is usually gets wasted with the five senses, and especially with thinking, is not used up anymore. Because there's all this energy which isn't leaking out, and instead it goes into the mind. Your mind really brightens up. It's, you know what, I keep on calling powerful mindfulness. Your mind is really boosted. So what you feel, because before the five senses disappear, what you feel is very, very strong. What you smell, you just go outside and smell a flower and it's just incredible. And just every leaf which you see on a tree is almost like fluorescing. You know, you're this really deep, powerful greens and blues and sounds and tastes. Everything is just like amplified. Usually not disturbingly amplified, but very powerful. At this point, I usually quote William Blake, "To see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, eternity in an hour." Really getting into some deep, powerful senses, because the five hindrances are being suppressed. So that you're experiencing a very powerful mind. And first of all, that powerful mind is very joyful, very blissful. And that bliss, naturally occurring bliss, incredibly strong, that is what pulls you in. But if any of you have ever experienced some powerful states of mind, you experience they're a bit sort of, can I hold this power? Scary, exciting. So that is what you hold on instead of letting go. Tiny little bit of last bit of grasping, holding on onto the object of bliss, which makes it unstable, which means you move off. But then it's so powerful, it draws you back in, irresistible. That is what we call like the wobble. In a couple of places, Venerable Sariputta is one of the people who described this, was a in-between of first and second jhana. Where? That there's no moving on to the object anymore. Because you settled on the object, but there's still a little bit of holding on. Not enough holding on to the object that is going to disturb the stability of it. The mind doesn't move off, but there's still a little bit of clinging onto the object left. That is, you know, called the avitaka savichara. Without the moving onto the object, but still some of the holding onto it. But that is going to come later on. So, it's important to know that that first jhana is having abandoned the five hindrances. The five hindrances, I think many of you may know those five hindrances. The five hindrances, number one is, it's not sensory delight. That is karma sukha. This is karma chanda. The word karma, K-long-A-M-A, describes the five sense realm. You're no longer involved or concerned with the five sense realm. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. That has disappeared. The five sense realm. And that's karma chanda. Because of that, so there's no interest in the five sense realm. The five sense realm starts to disappear. So, five hindrances, karma chanda is gone. Avyapada, ill will, obviously gone. No restlessness, the mind is not moving. And no sloth and torpor, no doubt. and free from unwholesome states and hindrances, so I put to enter upon and abide in the first jhana, wherein the mind moves on to the object and holds on to it, the object being joy and pleasure caused by being totally free from the five senses. The five senses and the body are no longer active. That's like being free from a prison. The prison being the body. And here we come. I told this to a few people before. I can't be serious for an hour. This is heavy Dhamma. But the proof that the body is a prison is because it's made up of cells. That was the Nibuto's joke. But anyway, that if you are free from a prison, of course, you know, you're happy. You're free. You can go and come and go where you like. There's always a sense of happiness when the body is vanished for a little while. People who have experiences, near-death experiences, when their bodies just vanish for a while, they're dead. They enjoy that experience. It's pleasant being free from this body. That, it becomes the bliss of a first jhana. Now, this is where we get some debate. And the states in the first jhana, the movement of the mind onto the object, the bliss, the mind holding the bliss, the rapture, the pleasure, and the oneness of mind, that's standard. The contact, experience, perception, will, and mind consciousness, chittang. Now, the contact is sensory contact. There are six types of sensory contact. The contact with the eyes, with the ears, with the nose, with the taste, and with the body, and also with the mind. Every one of those six senses always has, you know, the corresponding passa, contact. Experience, the Vedana, instead of like feeling, it's the three types of experience when you're going to classify them, you know, pleasant, unpleasant, in between. But that's just a way of just classifying the experience. Just like you classify the fauna, you know, the animal life, you know, into the different categories of animal life. You know, whether it's the Homo sapiens or all these other species, but always just classifying what we call like life. And so the three types of experience, it doesn't mean you're focusing on those experiences, on which particular type it is. It means it's experience. And the perception, the will, that's the sankhara, and mind consciousness. Not any of the other consciousnesses. There are six types of consciousness, like the six types of passa, the six types of senses. Here it specifically says, just the what's there is chitta, the mind, not the other senses. All it says is just the mind, not other, any other sense bases. Which is a very sort of interesting argument to actually to say that even in these jhanas, there is none of the other senses happening. There is no sort of hearing, sight, smell, taste, or body touch consciousnesses. Only the jitta, the sixth sense consciousness. Now the other ones, the approval, the chanda, here they call it usually zeal. And chanda doesn't mean zeal, it's a word which I got to know out of the Vinaya. Monasteries work in a democratic system, the oldest continuous democracy in our world. And so when a monastery has a decision to make, that we have to have a meeting, everybody concerned has to be present. If they can't be present for one reason or another, they send their chanda. It's like a proxy. It's like an approval. It's so you can go ahead without me. So that gives you an idea of what this word chanda doesn't mean like desire. It means approval, I think, is perhaps the best word for it. and decision adimoko. Now, what does that mean, decision? I told you this is a controversial one, but there was another series of party words. It's a bit of a party class because now other people will be looking at this online and will be trying to dissect this. And with the decision, that is the word which I came across first of all in the 64 Mahamalunkya Putta Sutta, where there's a group of four words always tend to come together. And that was, Pakandati, Pasidati, Santitati, Vimuchati, or sometimes Adimuchati, from where we get the word Adimokkha from. And those four words, Pakandati, meant when you actually get to a very beautiful state of mind, or you know, you get to some peace, you get to something inspiring, the mind literally leaps onto it. It's the word which, like a deer, will actually leap around in a forest. But this is leaping on to that state of mind. And hopefully many of you have had those experiences in meditation. You can see where there's a beautiful, peaceful state. The mind leaps onto it. And Pasidati, it gets this like confidence, joy in it. Santitati, it rests on it. It can stay there. And the last word is Adimuchati is used only once. Vimuchati is used about 30 times in the same sequence. Vimuchati means it becomes free. And I mentioned that again to Bhikkhu Bodhi, but he sort of said, no, I follow Nyanamoli. And I think Nyanamoli was one of the first persons who did this, not Nyanaponika. And it was hard to agree with, simply because decision doesn't make any sense. What decision? But the freedom, Vimuchati, being released, does make a lot of sense there. So, and the next... Oh, get out of here. Okay, oh no. Boy, where am I going? Why? Marvelous. There you go. Ah, thank you. Thank you. Tech support. This is not the one. Okay, this is good enough. I don't think this is the... It's not the one on the stick. Nope, it's not the one on the stick. Need a stick.
On the stick.
Is it one? Yeah. Any questions? Okay, we can go a bit further because now you see why.
That's right, yeah. In a few moments.
Okay. And the states in the first jhana, the movement of the mind onto the object, this is still number four. The mind holding the bliss, the rapture, the pleasure, the oneness of mind, the contact experience, waiting of perception with a mind consciousness, the approval, decision, I would say freedom, energy, mindfulness, equanimity, and the attention. These states were analyzed, vavatitta, by him, step by step. Known to him, those states arose, known they were present, known they disappeared. He understood thus, so indeed, these states not having been, come into being, having been, they vanished. Regarding those states, he abided unattracted, unrepelled, independent, detached, free, dissociated. Now the Samyutta Nikaya, when things come together, this is the opposite, with Samyutta. With a mind unrestricted, he understood there is an escape beyond, and with the cultivation of that, he confirmed that there is. The escape beyond means something a bit further, a way past this. So, I'll just go on a little bit further, but when it says in there that the usual translation, which I don't agree with at all, and I don't think makes any sense at all. When it says he knew these as they occurred, one by one, that makes absolutely no sense at all to me. That means the mind can really move and has a much more ability to do stuff within a jhana, which is not what happens in a jhana. In a jhana, you are still. It's oneness of mind. And anyway, see what goes into a second jhana. Again, monks, when the mind no longer moves into the object because it lets go of holding on to it, Sariputta went upon the abide in the second jhana, which has trust in the object. That is the word which is usually called self-confidence. But again, it doesn't make much sense in that particular type of deep meditation. There's no sense of self there at all. This is where, you know, you've mostly disappeared and you're continuing to disappear a lot. What actually is happening there is, remember what I was saying about in the first jhana, there's still that little bit of holding on. The confidence is actually allows you to let go, totally. Similar to what I used to see in a shopping center when a mother was holding her kid, even though it was really dangerous and was just being bumped all over the place in busy traffic, that nevertheless the kid would go asleep in his mother's arms. Had so much confidence in the mother, could totally let go. That is what happens, that type of confidence happens when a person gets into that second jhana. You don't need to do anything. That is where letting go really happens. Totally, 100%. There's lots of letting go for the first jhana. Now, really big letting go. And a unity of mind without any movement or holding, with joy and pleasure caused by absolute stillness. And the states in the second jhana, the trust, the joy, the pleasure, and the unity of mind, that's standard. And this is the weird one. Contact, experience, perception, will, and mind consciousness, okay. The approval, decision, energy, mindfulness, equanimity, and attention, these states were analyzed by him step by step. Known to him, those states arose. Known they were present. Known they disappeared. He understood thus, and with the cultivation of that attainment, he confirmed there is. Now we're going to go skip to right at the very end of this. There is the Citta Samyutta, chapter 41, Sutta 8, Nigantha Nataputta. Can you skip to that? The end? You got there? Very good. Now, on that occasion, Nigantha Nataputta, who was the same as Mahavira, the leader of the Jains, had arrived at Machikasanda together with a large retinue of Nigantas, the Jains. Nigantha meant people who untied the knot. It was a synonym for people who were free from attachment. They untied the knot to existence and rebirth. Citta, the householder, heard about this, and together with a number of lay followers of the Buddha, approached Nigantha Nataputta. He exchanged greetings with Nigantha Nataputta, and when they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, sat down to one side. And in this, just now to make a point, I've used Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation verbatim. Nigantha Nataputta then said to him, householder, do you have faith in the ascetic Gotama, which is the Buddha, when he says there is a concentration, samadhi? You know it can't be my translation because concentration, I far prefer the word stillness. There is a concentration without thought and examination. There is a cessation of thought and examination. So the leader of the Jains is asking him, you know, do you believe it when the Buddha says there's an ending of thought and examination, there's a cessation of thought and examination? In this matter, venerable sir, says Citta the householder, I do not go by faith in the Blessed One when he says there is concentration without thought and examination. There is a cessation of thought and examination. When this was said, Nigantha Nataputta looked up proudly towards his own retinue and said, see this, sirs, how straightforward is this Citta, the householder, how honest and open. One who thinks thought and examination can be stopped might imagine he could catch the wind in a net or arrest the current of the river Ganges with his own fist. What do you think, venerable sir, replied Citta, which is superior, knowledge or faith? Knowledge, householder, is superior to faith. Well, venerable sir, to whatever extent I wish, I enter and dwell in the first jhana. With the subsiding of thought and examination, I abide in the second jhana. With the subsiding of thought and examination, the third jhana, the fourth jhana. Since I know and see thus, Venerable Sir, in what other ascetic or Brahmin need I place faith regarding the claim that there is a concentration without thought and examination? There is a cessation of thought and examination. When this was said, Nigantha Nataputta looked askance at his own retinue and said, "See this, sirs, how crooked is this chitta, the householder. How fraudulent and deceptive." In other words, hope you can understand what he was saying over there. That he was saying, I don't believe that, I know it. There is an ending of thought, even in the second jhana, even the vitakka vichara, which an examination, and even using those words. So it makes it a bit of an inner contradiction to say that there can be thought and examination within the second jhana, third jhana, or fourth jhana, when even the householders knew there's none of that happens in the second, third, or fourth. No matter what translation or rendering of vitakka vichara, this thought and examination you have. So, and the states in the second jhana, the trust, the joy, the pleasure, the unity of mind, the contact, experience, perception, will, and mind consciousness, approval, decision, energy, mindfulness, equanimity, and attention, these states were analyzed by him step by step. No way could that be done within any jhana. Otherwise, chitta the householder would be wrong. And also, so would the Buddha. Known to him these states arose, known they were present, known they had disappeared. He understood thus, and with the cultivation of that attainment confirmed that there is. Again, monks, with the fading away of joy, Sariputra abided mindfully and fully aware, experience of bliss purified from joy. He entered and abided in the third jhana, account of which noble ones announced one as a pleasant abiding indeed, with such mindfulness and equanimity. Now in that third jhana, mindful and equanimous. The jhana is in a state where you are asleep. You are mindful, very mindful. But equanimous, peaceful. Sometimes I think I should translate it as content instead of equanimity. Equanimity I think has been a bit overused, like content, happy. You just don't need anything. You can sit there for hours. And the states in the third jhana, the equanimity, the pleasure, the mindfulness, the full awareness and unity of mind, that's standard, the contact, experience, perception, will and mind consciousness, the approval, decision, energy, mindfulness, equanimity and attention. Hey, hang on. Why have they got mindfulness and equanimity twice there? The equanimity, the pleasure, the mindfulness, and later down, the mindfulness, equanimity and attention. And to people like Ajahn Sujata, Ajahn Bamali, Venerable Professor Analio, German, in Hamburg University, that makes it sus, as we would say. Why would they be repeating these things twice? And these are the same standard lines, added, in each one of these. So, and with the cultivation of that attainment, he confirmed there was something beyond fourth jhana. And again, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, having abandoned pleasure and pain, all Vedana from the five senses, the disappearance of joy and unhappiness, all Vedana from the sixth sense, except for equanimity, Sariputta entered upon the abiding in the fourth jhana, which is only neutral mental Vedana, mental experience. Remaining just pure mindfulness with equanimity. Idiom of Pali. Hey, hang on. Does that mean to go from the third jhana to the fourth jhana? That what you have to do now is abandon all of the experience from all the experiences from the five senses, any happiness, unhappiness, or neutral feelings from the five senses. Wasn't that done a long time ago? Of course it was. Those things, many of those things were abandoned when you got into the first jhana. It's almost summing up, because the fourth jhana is the culmination of serenity, of freedom from the five senses, of stillness. And So put enter Ponnabide in the fourth jhana, which has only neutral mental Vedana remaining, just pure mindfulness with equanimity. And you mention that pure, it's a parisuddha, the acme, the apex of mindfulness, the most pure mindfulness you can ever have in the fourth jhana. That's why it's called the purity of mindfulness. Really still, really aware. And because all the other things which stop you being aware, the five senses, and all the pleasure, pain in between of the five senses, and also the pleasure and the pain of the mind, that has all vanished, really still. But, according to what I say and other people say has been added onto the sutta, the unity of mind, the contact, experience, perception, will and mind consciousness, fair enough, but the will. Where there's a will, there is agitation. The approval, decision, energy, mindfulness, equanimity and attention, okay. These states were analyzed by him step by step. Known to him those states arose, known they were present, known they disappeared. He understood thus, and with the cultivation of that attainment he confirmed there is. So the idea of analyzing these things within even a fourth jhana, there's no equanimity, there's no contentment, there's no real peace when you do analysis. So this has to be an analysis, understanding, coming and going after you come out from these states. And now, just to make it more interesting for those of you who like to have your minds bent, with things which are really hard to understand, but which are real. Oh, first of all, any questions so far? Okay, let's go a bit further. And with the previous complete transcending of perceptions of form, those were actually, the form has to be, the only way you can know form stuff, knows with the five senses, that ended a long time ago. And the same as we're summing up with the fourth jhana, where the five senses and the pleasure pain in between had been transcended. It's not what happens between these jhanas, it's just this is the foundation. With the disappearance of perceptions of sensory impact, with non-attention to perceptions of diversity, aware that space is unlimited, Sariputta enters upon abiding in the mind base of unlimited space. Instead of calling it infinite space, any of you who were listening to my talk on Friday, that space is not infinite. It has a volume to it. When was the Big Bang, so to speak? And I say it was 13 billion years ago. And so, you can actually pretty much say this universe has a volume of 13 billion light years radius. What was it, 4/3 pi r cubed is the radius of a sphere. That is its volume at the most. It's not infinite. And again, as I'm mentioning there, because space is curved, that you don't go out to the end of, how many billion light years would I say? 13 billion light years from here, and you can see the edge of the universe, because that's not how this universe works. It's if you go to any place, it always looks as if it's the center. The idea of a balloon being blown up, and I expand it, you blow it, and the little dots in it get further apart. That's a two-dimensional analogy to the three dimensions of space. As the universe expands, the dots get further apart. But no dot is the center of the universe. No galaxy, no part is the center. You have to change some of your perceptions here, but that is standard perception of the nature of our universe. It's not infinite, but it is unbounded. There's no edge to it. Planet Earth it's not infinite. You know sort of how much area there is in planet Earth. But it is, unlimited, it's unbounded, it hasn't got an edge to it. Now you get an idea of what we're actually doing here. Oh my goodness, I keep touching this thing. Well, it should be up here somewhere. Yeah, good, okay. It's a circle, but that is not quite. It's a circle ever expanding. So you can never get to the ground to the other side. Weird. Always time is making more time. No end of it. But no beginning either. So sometimes we think philosophy should be easy. But all it really means is a limited perception. Our framework needs to be changed, expanded, to be able to understand some of these things. I'm trying to make it as easy as possible. And anyway, what was I getting to? Number 7, 8, whatever. Oh, unlimited space. Okay. And unlimited space and the unity, okay. And the states in the mind base of unlimited space, the perception of the mind base of unlimited space, the unity of mind, the contact, the experience, perception, will, and mind consciousness, the approval, decision, energy, mindfulness, equanimity, and attention. These states were analyzed by him step by step. Known to him, those states arose. Known they were present. Known they disappeared. He understood thus. And with the cultivation of that attainment, he confirmed there was. To have such refined states and to have any activity in there becomes even more sort of unlikely. Unlikely to the point that it's impossible. Now, again, what this means, to put it in language, I hope you can understand. Is it working? Uh-oh. Have we been hacked? Okay, it's going. Okay, good. The one way of understanding this, what's actually happening here, is when any of your senses, or the six senses, become still, close your eyes. I'm not seeing anything. And after a while, my sense of sight is still. This object, which is the inside of my eyelids, doesn't move. After a little while, it turns off. Stillness. You can open your eyes now. As many of you know, some of the stories I've told, that when I was over in the Zen monastery as a layman, staring at a white wall, didn't know at all what I was supposed to do, which was helpful, not being told. Staring at a white wall, and then the wall vanished. It just went out of existence. There was not a hole there. There was nothing there. It was weird. And all it really was teaching me a very good lesson. If your mind is still, no, reasonably still, not thinking, you're just watching and not afraid, after a while, things disappear. The default state. These days, you compare it, you're not pressing this, the screen will go black. Default state, things turn off when they're not active. So, in meditation, you're keeping still, physically, comfortably, body's disappearing, this is closed, reasonably quiet place, so you're not sort of having noise and bells and people revving up their motorbikes. So this ambient noise means you don't hear anything after a while. The body is comfortable, that disappears. Even the saliva in your throat, which now you may notice, after a while, because nothing happens, it disappears. You can't feel anything, you can't smell, you can't taste, you can't touch. The five senses shut down. Now the mind is beginning to shut down. Now the mind objects are still. The purity of mindfulness and equanimity, stillness, contentment. Which means once your mind, like every other senses, is still, now that object starts to disappear. Your mind turns off. Just like when looking at a blank wall, my eyes turned off. Even though they were fully open, the wall disappeared. The objects of the mind now vanish. And that's the arupa states. The unlimited space, sign that your objects of the mind are vanishing. Completely surmounting the mind base of unlimited space, aware that consciousness is unlimited, so put went upon abiding in the mind base of unlimited consciousness. Unbounded, just, it's disappearing. Reason why I say it's disappearing, any of you who've really got into the present moment awareness, something which I think you can get your head around, because ever since Eckhart Tolle's book, The Power of Now, many more people actually can appreciate what now means, and especially in your meditation, and even getting into any type of present moment awareness, you'll find it's like unlimited time, unbounded time. In other words, in that state, time doesn't exist, it's beginning to disappear. You have all the time in the world when you're in the present moment. It's unlimited. But it also disappears at the same time. The old mathematical idea of just infinity and zero being so close together. Because it means there can be no more measurement. When you don't measure things, they start to vanish. So, space, time, space and consciousness are now vanishing. Unlimited, unmeasured, unbounded, infinite if you wish, but it means they're going, disappearing. This is what the arupa states are actually happening, is that your mind is turning off. The last of your six senses, or rather I shouldn't say your six senses, the last of the six senses which you identify with as being who you are. And completely surmounting the mind base of unlimited consciousness, aware that there is nothing, so put went upon abide in the mind base of nothingness. Remember the beautiful teaching of Ajahn Chah to me? And when Ajahn Chah said, "Baba Wangso, why?" I don't know. So he was kind enough to tell me the answer. There's nothing. There's nothing. I always remember that when he said there's nothing. And the states in the mind base of nothingness, the perception of the mind base of nothingness, and the unity of mind, the contact, experience, perception, will, and the mind consciousness, the approval, decision, energy, mindfulness, equanimity, and attention. I thought there was nothing there. And it's all these things. So that's a bit dodgy. These states were analyzed by him step by step, known to him those states arose, known they were present, known they disappeared. He understood thus the cultivation of that table, and he confirmed there is something beyond. And again, monks, by completely surmounting the mind base of nothingness, so put to enter upon and abide in the base of neither perception or non-perception. At least here there's a little bit of accuracy. He emerged mindful from that attainment, having done so, he contemplated the states that had passed, ceased and changed thus. That's good, because in neither perception or non-perception, your mind is really getting so close to turning off, as if there is no perception. But you know there's no perception. You perceive there's no perception. You may say I sound like a Zen koan, but it's just like the mind is almost gone. Because it's too still. It's turning off. It's like when the computer turns off, there's nothing on the screen. The screen is still there. But the next stage is even the screen vanishes. And I always say that's not covered by the warranty. Not on my little tablet, anyway. So, he emerged mindful from that attainment. Having done so, he recalled the states that had ceased and changed thus. So indeed, these states, not having been, come into being, having been, they vanished. Regarding those states, he abided unattracted, unrepelled, independent, detached, free, disassociated, with a mind rid of barriers. He understood there is no escape beyond. And with the cultivation of that attainment, he confirmed there is not. So this is no escape beyond means this is as far as the mind can go. Disappears. I didn't actually. I missed paragraph 19. By completely surmounting the base of neither perception nor non-perception, so put entered upon and abided. I did actually go too far. Okay. Okay, so I went too far there. I missed a couple of paragraphs. So I go back to paragraph 17, just so I can be precise and full. Again, monks, by completely surmounting the mind base of nothingness, Sariputta entered upon the abide in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. He emerged mind from that attainment, having done so, contemplated the states that had passed, ceased, and changed. So indeed, these states, not having been come into being, they vanished. Regarding those states, he abided unattracted, unrepelled, independent, detached, free, dissociated, the mind rid of barriers, and he understood there is an escape beyond neither perception nor non-perception, and with the cultivation of that attainment he confirmed there is. And again, monks, by completely surmounting the base of neither perception nor non-perception, Sariputta entered upon and abided in the cessation of perception and experience. And his outflowings, they call them sometimes the taints, the asavas, were destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. So, completely surmounted and entered upon the state of cessation of perception and all experience. You can't have experience without perception. Perception and experience have to go together. So here your mind is turning off. It's turned off. So emerged mind from that attainment, having done so, recalled the states that had passed, ceased, and changed us. So indeed these states, not having been, come into being. Having been, they vanish, even the mind consciousness, the will, experience, everything ceased. With the mind rid of barriers, understood, there's no escape beyond the cessation of the mind. Nothing left to escape from. And with the cultivation of that attainment, he confirmed there is not. And that's when he became Arahat. Rightly speaking, were it to be said of anyone, he has attained mastery in perfection, noble virtue, attained mastery in perfection, noble stillness, attained mastery in perfection, noble wisdom, attained mastery in perfection, noble deliverance. It is a Sariputta indeed that rightly speaking this should be said. Monks, rightly speaking, were to be said of anyone, he is the son of the Blessed One, born of the breast, born of the mouth, born of the Dhamma. And that, if you know the Brahmin claim in the time of the Buddha, they said they were born of the mouth. Was it the mouth or the heart of the Brahma? It was the mouth. Yeah, the mouth. Real sons, born of the breast, born of the mouth, born of Brahma. That's what they claim to being a Brahmin. So this was Brahmin speak. But instead of the Brahma, you know, the god, this was talking about the Dhamma. Created by the Dhamma, an heir to Dhamma, not an heir in material things. It is Sariputta indeed that rightly should be said. Monks, the matchless wheel of Dhamma set rolling by the Tathagata is kept rolling rightly by Sariputta. And sometimes you wonder, but Sariputta died before the Buddha passed away. Anyway. So that is the Anupada Sutta, not one by one as they occurred, because you cannot know these states as they occur. The mind is too still. You know them after you emerge. And there's a couple of other problems with this sutta. Namely, where is he? Is good old Peter Bickerton? Is he here? No, he's not here. Okay, but even he is smart enough to say, hang on a bit, that if, you know, if somebody has gone through the Arupa states, they are actually not, where is it? Okay. Again, monks by complete samadhi, this is paragraph 19, Sariputta, his outflowings were destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. Anyone who's gone through the Arupa states is defined as being freed both ways. not just by wisdom. Being freed by wisdom means that a person has got the liberation, the enlightenment by at least one of the jhanas, but none of the immaterial jhanas. We couldn't call them jhana, immaterial attainments. So there is even Peter Bickerton, saw that one. Hey, there's an anomaly there. But the biggest anomaly was it's actually said that that was actually how the Sariputta was supposed to become enlightened. The sentence here somewhere. Okay, in paragraph 2. During half a month, monks, Sariputta gained insight into steps, state by state. Now, against that, we also have the other story of how Sariputta became enlightened, which is different. In the Diganaka Sutta, number 74. And many of you have ever been on pilgrimage to India. Up on the way, just a little bit before you get to the Vulture's Peak, there is what is called the Boar's Cave. Very well signposted. And there, the Diganaka Sutta was happened. Number 74 of the Majjhima Nikaya. And it was apparently the nephew of Sariputta that was getting a Dhamma talk from the Buddha, and Sariputta was the Buddha's attendant at the time, was fanning him at the time, and was listening to what was being said. And on that occasion, the Venerable Sariputta was standing behind the Blessed One, fanning him. Then he thought, the Blessed One indeed speaks of the abandoning of these things through direct knowledge. The Sublime One indeed speaks of relinquishing of these things through direct knowledge. And as the Venerable Sariputta considered us, through not clinging, his mind was liberated from the taints. So this is another story of the Sariputta's enlightenment, which was different. It's hard to reconcile with the 2 weeks of getting these wisdom through the jhanas and the arupa states. So that was one of the reasons why that I haven't mentioned this sutta before. It has a lot of difficulties with it. And again, you go back to the authenticity of the early Buddhist texts, Ajahn Sujata, Bhamali, and also Anālaya. There's no known parallels in the non-Pali Buddhist early texts where this, or the Majjhima Nikaya, this is, I think, nearly all of the other ones. Is it all the other ones? I think just about all the other ones, but this one just doesn't exist in any Chinese version. Just this one. Extravagant praise for Sariputta, even this one, the Diganaka, when it says he got enlightened, he didn't actually praise him. He just, like usual praise, but nothing more. And duplication, redundancy of using equanimity and mindfulness twice. And some of the vocabulary, the words, which you don't find anywhere else in the suttas, only in the Abhidhamma, are actually in here. And it's also some of the stuff which is there doesn't really make sense. It's not consistent. Even Sariputta's enlightenment. So, you can make of that what you want. But it has a few problems to it. Yes? Where it came from, if you look at the history of the Buddhism and how it developed, the ways of becoming enlightened, even in those days, the history shows that the standards for enlightenment itself being an arahat, started going down. And in Thikkhin Nikatawattu, which is supposed to be the in the Abhidhamma, but this was obviously a later edition, a later time, because internal evidence is really clear that the Buddha They were asking, can a person who is an arahat become a non-arahat? Can they regress? Now, the answer is always, no way. Arahat fruit. No, I'm talking about the arahat fruit. You're an arahat, that's it. Taint's destroyed. This is your last life, no more of anything. Because what was happening was there was a few monks who were arahats, but they started to misbehave. So what was going on there? Was it the case, oh yeah, well I was an arahat, but then sort of, you know, a real arahat, but then sort of, you know, I went backwards. And there's a whole argument about that. So what was actually happening there, you could actually see the standards for being an arahat were actually going down, 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 down. Because the only way you could actually, if you were following a teacher, and you said, this is spiritual materialism. My teacher is better than your teacher. My master, no, they've got jhanas, your master hasn't. That sort of stuff. And so what actually happens is that people tend, especially if you're in a teaching position, you tend to actually give yourself too much benefit of the doubt. And I've seen that happening so many times in my life as a monk, where sometimes, I remember this, you know that great monk I respected, the Ajahn Tate, when I went to ask my questions, and the lady went in there before me, I was just listening to her asking Ajahn Chah these questions. After Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Tate these questions. And she kept on asking, now, this is my experience in meditation. That was fourth jhana, wasn't it? And Ajahn said, no, that's not fourth jhana. That's just a bit of dullness. No, that's fourth jhana, wasn't it? I said, not dullness. Said, no, that was dullness. And she kept on asking Ajahn Tate for this because, you know, her mind was really still and it's equanimous. It wasn't moving. He was asleep, basically. But she kept on asking and asking and asking and asking until Ajahn Tate said, And she smiled and went out. See, he confirmed it. Because she was hearing what she wanted to hear. And she wasn't going to leave until she had it confirmed. It wasn't confirmed. I was there at the time. I saw it happen. So sometimes getting people to approve, you're the only one who will ever know. So anyway, that is the state of jhanas. In my lifetime, I've seen them go down. What some teachers call jhana light. And there's very well-known teachers, I won't say who they are, lay teachers. And L-I-T-E. Well, it's not really, it's like jhana light, you know, just L-I-T-E, like the American version of, not the real full thing, but you know, it's good enough, isn't it? Say, no, it's not. They say, but, you're making it too difficult for us. Remember Ajahn Sujato showing me a question in the blog. He said, well, but if you make jhanas so difficult, it means that we just can't get jhanas, we ordinary people. Well, no, we can't change the definitions, you know, of these things. You know, what is the temperature of boiling water? Just because you can't get enough energy to boil some water, you can't say, oh, well, okay, for you, you know, we'll make it only sort of 90 degrees Fahrenheit. Or centigrade, sorry. So, but sometimes, well, come on, just compassion, make it easy for us. But you know, that's, you know, laughter, that's what you see. And so, some of these things over here were trying to make it so that during the jhanas, you could have mental activity. So that people could come along and say, I was peaceful, but it must have been a jhana, because I had a bit of happiness. But, you know, when it comes to, you know, sometimes people don't like me if I say these things, but, you know, I have to be honest, you know, with how the Buddha taught, how Ajahn Chah taught. So that's where it comes from, wistful thinking. Trying to lower the standards, which is human nature. And then actually you get a very famous teacher, because all my disciples, they get jhanas, fourth jhanas, they get sort of immaterial states, they get enlightened. If you are enlightened, then there's consequences. No fear, no anger. That's why I remember the story when I thought I was enlightened. I really thought I was. Until the monk I was staying with put the rotten fish curry together with the pork curry, mixed them all together. I mean, oh God, I'm not enlightened after all. I got upset and angry. Or the other one in the Chinese tradition about the monk staying in the island. And then he was enlightened, so he wanted to tell his teacher that he was enlightened. How can you say anything to them? So he got did some calligraphy. The calligraphy, absolutely perfect calligraphy, because meditated very deeply, really still. And when he came out of meditation, he wrote the poem in four lines. The diligent monk alone for, how many years was it? 3 years? Seven years, I think. Diligent monk alone for 7 years is no longer moved by the four worldly winds. And the four worldly means nothing actually just bothers you anymore. And so he wrote that in perfect calligraphy, rolled it up in a scroll and sent it to his master. And a week later the master sent back his reply. And the reply was the same scroll. And through the first line, the diligent monk, he'd written in red pen, fart. And the second line, red pen, fart in capital letters. The third line, fart, 2 exclamation marks, underlined, or something like that. Anyway, the fourth one, really big fart, F-A-R-T, exclamation mark, underlined 3 times. And that monk was livid. You can't do this to a scroll which has just been composed by a living, enlightened being. And so he was just so upset. He sort of, he was actually in an island. He got the attendant to row him back to the abbot's office, stormed into the abbot's office, threw it down on the table and said, "You can't say this. This is a piece of history. This should be in a museum. You can't destroy this beautiful historic calligraphy written by a newly minted arahat." And so he opened the scroll of the abbot. Okay. The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, seven years, whatever it was, is no longer moved by the four worldly winds. Yet 4 little farts have blown you clean across the lake. Oh, the monk got it and figured out he wasn't enlightened after all. Had to go back and do some real meditation. So I think that's where it came from. A bit of wishful thinking. And the last little piece was that whenever you look at one sutta, or especially something which has got a little bit of dodginess to it, you know, like having no parallels elsewhere and just some of the inconsistencies with the rest of the Pali canon, that's where you have to interpret and then judge not on its own, but in light of all the other mass of teachings you find in the suttas. Because in those suttas there's a whole mass of teachings there. Like the Eightfold Path. And there, and you see exactly what can be the Buddha's teachings, what aren't. So don't just interpret out of just one, which sometimes, you know, we can twist this way, twist that way, to suit ourselves. So, be careful. Anyway, any questions from overseas? See if I've stirred up a hornet's nest. Here we go. From Canada. Why is it that these progressive states of jhana almost appear to be intelligently designed in such a way to intentionally lead to Noah the conclusion that leads to nirvana? It is intelligently designed. This is not like an intelligent design, like a creator design these things. This is just the nature of the world. Just like, did somebody design the law of gravity or electromagnetism, or did someone intelligently design quantum mechanics? If they did, they set the standards so high that only a few people can really understand quantum mechanics. It's just too complicated. Was that an intelligent design, or that's just the nature of this world? It's not intelligently designed, it's just the nature of this mind when it starts to stop. Such a way to intentionally lead the knower to the conclusions that lead to nirvana? No, it leads the knower to disappear. Nirvana means cessation, extinguishment. That's the Ratana Sutta. Yatayang padi, no. What's the last word? The last verse. Kina beach avivuti chanda nibanti dira yatayang padipa. Nibanti is a verb associated with nibbana. It means it nibbanaed. Just like the flame of an oil lamp. That's what nibbana means. It goes out, extinguished. Just like the Agga Vajragotha Sutta, where the flame just goes out. Where does it go to? Said Vajragotha. What do you mean, where does it go to? It's extinguished, finished, poof, gone, disappeared, vanished. It doesn't go anywhere. It was just causes and conditions. The causes stop, the conditions stop. Never to arise again. So, it leads the knower, it doesn't lead the knower, it leads the knower to doubt its own existence. To the point that the knower vanishes. But not in the sense of having a psychological breakdown of, what they call it, the lack of self-identity. Because you're really peaceful, full of joy. So because of that, you don't get the identity crisis which people have when they've still got their five senses and restlessness and doubt controlling their minds. What brings a person out of jhana from USA? What can bring a person out of first jhana, if it's not that deep, is sound. Sound is called the thorn of a first jhana. Which is why there was... I remember Angie Monksfield's auntie, who went into a coma for quite a long time apparently. And what brought her out of a coma? You know, she was deep inside, but you know, she's not cognizant of the body or sound or anything. And because she actually came out of this and she gave lectures, which I used to listen to, she said it was the sound of a temple bell. Just brought her out of that deep state. Sound gets you out of the first jhanas and states of coma sometimes. Which is why, you know, if somebody's on the edge, you talk to them. But not aggressively, softly, to bring them out. It's a beautiful sound of a temple bell. Brought her out. Just like the alarm clock in the morning gets you out from the coma of sleep. So that's if somebody is in a deep meditation. Sometimes you can just very softly speak into their ear. Sometimes it might come out. But if they're very deep, you have just to wait. So what comes out, just like every other state, it is impermanent. When it's letting go, energy fades. Then you come out. Alternatively, you can set the inner clock, which is what monks usually, nuns, anyone who's in jhanas, who does jhanas a lot, they tell themselves, I have to come out by a certain time. You do that while you still can speak, and you can listen to what you're saying, or just thinking. Sitting there, I must come out at a certain time. You say the time. And then you disappear into your deep meditations, and then you come out of that time. Amazing what happens. And what was it that somebody was, I read about it, but didn't see too much about it. There was this Hindu ascetic who, you know, said he could do these things. So under laboratory situations, they put him, I think, in a box and they buried him underground. You know, I think it was 8 days or 9 days he was underground. But they had tubes and wires on him, and he's told exactly how long he's going to do this for. He's going to subdue all his life faculties for so many days, and then he's going to turn them on again. So he reprogrammed himself. And it actually worked. So they were watching him from down in the room above, and he was down below, I don't know how many feet, meters underneath, to make sure there was no funny business, he couldn't escape. And then all his life faculties stopped. And they waited and waited and waited and waited and waited and waited. Until the time he said, and then the life faculties turned on again, and they hauled him up, and he was fine. So that sort of stuff exists. Interesting, fascinating stuff. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm a little bit confused when you said about the sound brings on the
jhana. Only the first jhana.
The story you told us once about somebody who was taken to hospital because the wife thought...
That's right, that's great.
But why didn't the sound of her voice or
because
the ambulance...
He got too deep. He went past that first jhana.
Oh.
It's only in the first jhana. That's the only time that can take you out. When it's only just in and not a very deep first jhana.
Okay, thank you.
So you've gone beyond that. You know, remember that story I told on retreats about the fellow who was the Vietnamese monk in Sydney, who was supposed to be teaching a retreat and just sat there for 8 days, didn't move, didn't open his mouth, didn't go to the toilet, didn't take any drinks, food or anything. And he apologized after he came out of his meditation, saying that, you know, I'm sorry, but I didn't give any talks, didn't need any chanting, didn't give any instructions. I just got into a deep meditation and I forgot to put my inner timer on. It's not oversleeping, it's over jhana-ing, whatever you call it. So, those things happen. Another interesting little... Shall I go? No, just... This was one of the... if he's hearing this, he promised to send me the video of this. But he had one of his disciples, supposed to be a follower of mine, and he saw me in the hotel room in Colombo, you know, when it was on the last time I was in Sri Lanka for the conference, the World Buddhist Summit conference. And he said that one of his followers really gets into deep meditation, into the jhanas easily. And the fellow himself, he was a doctor. I think he worked in some of the military hospitals. And so, when his friend he was in deep meditation, he decided to test him out, you know, the doctor. He actually disinfected his arm, got out a scalpel, and tried to make an incision in his arm. And he couldn't cut him. The scalpel wouldn't cut. And so, it was really fascinating. He was videoing it, and then just, it wouldn't go through. And then, sort of, he asked him the next time, he said, look, is it okay if I do this experiment? Have your permission this time to see if I can, you know, see if you feel any pain, see what happens if I just make an incision when you're in a deep meditation. And so, this time, he went in deep meditation, and he did a little swab on his arm, and he did the incision, and actually it did cut him. And then he was no pain at all, his body sense had totally gone. And then he sort of sewed him up again, sort of disinfected, put on the bandage, whatever it was, and then he came out of meditation afterwards. Now, don't try that. Oh, someone is meditating. He did that only with permission, because I always remember that fellow Edgar Cayce, who used to get into a trance, and there's so many people who are dubious that they decided they had to test him out. So what they did, with his permission, they actually put slivers of wood between his fingernails. Because that's such a painful thing that, you know, you'd think that, you know, if he was just faking it, he would just, you know, scream or come out of his trance. But he was still in his trance. He wasn't moving at all. And he didn't mind doing that once, you know, because, you know, to prove that, you know, it was the real thing. But then these doctors, you know, who investigated him, they said, oh, it's real. Well done. And they told their friends over in New York and said, no, it can't be true. So they wanted to do their own experiments. And after a while, you know, his fingers were just really infected. You know, because it didn't hurt when it was happening, because it was just, his body had just vanished. But it sure hurt when he came out. And why was it that everybody had to prove it for themselves? It can't be true. Therefore, everyone wants to prove it again. So that's why I just wanted, okay, once is enough, take a video, but that was just doctored, fake news. I want to do it again in my surgery. And that poor fellow will have scars all over himself. Anyway, fascinating stuff. So what brings a person out of China is either just literally the karma of it, the amount of letting go energy which you went in, then when that's used up, you come out again. Or, and it's nothing to do with your will when you're in there, which is one of the reasons you have to put the timer on when you're in there, before you're in there, sorry. Otherwise, you'll be in there for 8 days or even longer. Otherwise, it's such still beautiful states. And someone said, why would you want to come out of the jhanas? And number one, if you did have any will, you say, oh no, I'm staying here, it's too much joy, too much fun. But the point is, your will has stopped. Still. Fascinating, interesting stuff. I hope, anyway. You got a question? Okay, visitor from the Tibetan tradition, yes.
She did some healing meditation here.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, she was saying that her grandfather, when he finished his work, he spent all his time meditating.
Oh, yeah.
And he was meditating and he never came out. He just died after many days.
Yeah. Okay.
Just thought it might be interesting.
Yeah. How old was he?
Oh, she didn't say. No.
Okay. I suppose that's okay if he just wanted to disappear. Were you sure he was dead? Yeah. But standard, please understand this, and it's important. If you do find anyone who just gets into a deep meditation and, you know, they've got no pulse or no sort of, you know, even in a hospital, that fellow Greg, his body was still warm. And that you find that in the Chula Wetula Sutta, the difference between being dead and in the deep meditations. For some reason or another, your body is still warm. So if you do find anybody in hospital who comes in and they're a meditator, they come in the ambulance and they're in full lotus, but there's no sign of life, just check their body temperature. And if they're still warm, it's in deep meditation. If they're cold, they're dead. That's the way to know. And that was actually with this fellow Greg. His body was still warm. Interesting. Okay, I think that's enough discombobulating you for one day. Haven't confused you too much, but it's good that we... Well, this is my own copy. Sometimes I'm not going to hold this out because I've let go so many times and I never get these books back. You can get it online. Sadhu, 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 sadhu. Okay, now we can just do three bars.